That hat makes you look like a girl.
Am I a pretty girl?
I'm on this stage because I am a pretty white woman. In my industry, we call that a sexy girl.
Will I be pretty? Will I be pretty? I will wipe that question from your mouth like cheap lipstick and answer no. The word pretty is unworthy of everything you will be, and no child of mine will be contained in five letters. You will be pretty intelligent, pretty creative, pretty amazing, but you will never be merely pretty.
The Wise Guides is a conversation show hosted by me, Amber Petty, that aims to extract some beautiful pearls of wisdom from our fabulous female guests who, like all of us, have learnt something about life worth sharing with the world. I love a good success story, especially if it's mine. This story, however, is not mine, but it's inspiring in so many ways because the girl in the story is a girl I knew many, many years ago when I worked in magazines. Back then, she was working for various music and teen mags as a writer, and I was in boring old marketing before moving on to a national mag where I wrote a really cheesy celebrity-style column, which still makes me slightly cringe when I look back at it, among other tiny moments in my life. So I'd lost touch with this girl over a decade or so ago. We used to be friends, not besties, but we enjoyed each other's humour, which others might have described at the time as an acquired taste. Anyway, I was doing a time waster trawl on Instagram one day last year when something caught my eye. It was a photo of Georgia Clark, the girl who used to be my friend, and there she is with her mouth open in a kind of mock shock look, and she's got a book in her hand, and she's got bloody Jessica Biel with her arm around her, pointing at the book, pulling a matching mock shock look. As I read the caption, which said, LA fam was out in full force to celebrate hashtag the regulars, the name of her book, including at Jessica Biel, who not only came to the launch but hosted our after party at AU Fudge, a magical night surrounded by the West Coast's finest. By the time I digested that Georgia has now moved on in the world and appears to now be besties with Jessica Biel, my face was understandably in mock shock. Mainly because this cool girl I used to know, the clever, funny and quirky girl I knew as Georgia Clark, has written a bloody book. And there appears to be a little global buzz about it, which really is just so bloody cool, especially for a wannabe author like me.
Hi, I'm Georgia Clark and I'm the author of The Regulars.
Georgia, I've just been recapping about how I came to realise where you were in the world at the moment. And basically that you'd written this amazing book called The Regulars, which I've now read. And noticing you on Instagram with none other than Jessica Biel, arm around you, you know, hosting your book launch in LA, I can't believe how much has gone on in your life since I last saw you here in Sydney. Can I just be a little bit of a nosy person? You can say whatever you want. How come you know Jessica Biel and she seems to really, really like you, like you're the really cool girl, not her?
Jess is definitely the cool girl. I met Jess through my girlfriend. So my girlfriend, Lindsay, is American. We met in New York. And she used to work with Jess in LA. So she's sort of from the West Coast.
Okay.
So that's all of that, that sort of connection, friend of girlfriend, which is actually a great way to meet. And in a certain way, the only way to instantly become very close with someone who is a public person like that,
yeah,
because when you're the, you get an instant pass as the partner, as the, you know, the girlfriend of the close friend.
So can't remember the year that we would have last seen each other, although I do think it's quite funny to note when we did speak the first time after I stalked you down via Instagram that you mentioned something that the last time that we saw each other that I was trying to get everyone to believe that we'd seen a UFO.
<That's>
which I just laughed about. I thought, oh my God, why am I like that? That sounds so much like something I do.
It was really funny. It was a party that we were going to and we had driven up together and we concocted a story in the car that when we would get there, we would tell everyone, straight face, no breaking, that we had an encounter with extraterrestrials. We weren't sure. But we were pretty sure that because there was no lights around us, we were in drive, because it was driving up to this party that was kind of in the middle of the bush or
in
something.
In the Blue Mountains, I think.
And that we'd suddenly seen these lights come out of nowhere.
No, we'd had an encounter.
And they'd come right down and that we'd seen something.
Okay.
And that was at the same party where I believe a party game that you started how many chopsticks could you fit in your mouth? And so you had everyone at the party fitting all of these chopsticks in their mouth. Really fun.
I do remember that, and I have a feeling that poor guy that I convinced to be the... Well, do you really want to win that title? Had about 50 chopsticks in his mouth.
He had many chopsticks in his mouth.
I think he needed stitches after that, the poor guy. Okay.
You were trouble. You've always been trouble.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'll just go back to the fact that I loved your book because we've got exactly the same sense of humour and imagination. But, okay, can you just do a recap? Because I know that there's lots of people, you know, I'm always banging on about the fact that I'm this wannabe aspiring author, you know, who lives in New York and has a girlfriend called Lindsay. Okay, that sounds a bit weird. No, I really would. I'd like to write a book that actually people cared about because your book is doing so well in... I know it's doing really well in Australia, but I know I'm really dismissive about Australia because I feel like, you know, there's only 10 of us here, but there's so many people. But you're popping up all over America, and those trashy mags that, let's be honest, sell squillions of copies are reviewing your book and saying it's brilliant. So just calming down from that a little, for anyone sitting there going, oh, I'd like to be an author one day, how does one go from, okay, so the last time I saw you, you were working in Sydney, we were both working at Pacific Magazines. I hadn't quite cracked a writing gig there yet, but you were writing for music and, like, teen entertainment titles. Have I made that up? That's right, isn't it?
That's right.
So how did you go from working in that kind of space in Sydney to ending up where you are now in New York?
Long story short, I had a young adult novel published in Australia. I was working for Girlfriend Magazine, one of the most popular teen magazines in Australia, and they released a line of standalone girlfriend fiction. So all of the books were young adult, aimed at girls 13 to 16 years old, all written by different authors. And because I was part of the girlfriend family, I was a long-time freelancer, they asked if I would pitch an idea. I sort of spent a weekend just putting an idea together. I'd never done anything like that before. I didn't really think it through. I didn't really think it was going to happen. And they said, yep, great, you can write that book. And I was like, what?
So what did they give? What did they set you up with?
Nothing. I mean, only just that it was for and about young adult is really defined as a genre by the fact that it usually is for teenagers and other readers, but it's usually about teenagers. So young adult, if you had to define it anyway, the characters are teenagers. And it was a story that was sort of modelled on a band that I used to be in my wild and crazy 20s, and it was just a one-off project in a way. It was a simple, it was a short, fun, simple story. It was 50,000 words, which is sort of on the shorter side as far as novel lengths go. It was, I definitely had like a minor breakdown writing it because I didn't know what I was doing, but then it came out. And I sort of thought, oh, well, that was that. You know, I wasn't actually looking to pursue novel writing at that stage. Right. I was really keen to get into screenwriting. I really wanted to get into being a television screenwriter. So I tried to do that for a long time. And after sort of final failure in Australia, I had a couple of things come up that allowed me to move to New York. I actually won a pitching competition, like a television and screenwriting pitching competition, actually a national competition. And one of the parts of the prize was a return flight anywhere in the world, which was very generous. Mm. And I also had done some freelance work. I was single. I was 29. It sort of was just a good time to make a move like that, like if not now, when sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I bit the bullet and planned to come to New York for 3 months just to kind of check it out, like extended holiday, do some writing kind of thing. And basically never left. I thought I would be able to get a job much easier than it turned out I could get a job. So, like, hot tip, your Australian credentials don't really carry in the US. I learned that lesson sort of the hard way and was really broke for a long time and unemployed and just barely scraping by, had a really cheap rent and all that kind of thing.
That's scary
and
in New York.
And in that time, I sort of always thought, oh, look, if it gets too hard, I can always come back home. And I have this distinct memory of, like, walking down 14th Street one day so broke and realising I can't even afford to go home. Like, oh, I can't afford to buy a ticket to get home. What happens when I get home? Like, I can't afford to, like, buy new furniture or get a place. And, like, I'm not going to move in with my parents in my early 30s kind of thing. So, like, I really had to make it work. Mm. in that time of being unemployed, I wrote a book that didn't sell, and then I wrote another YA novel that did sell and got a very small deal with a New York publisher, and it was called Parched. It was a sci-fi adventure, futuristic YA novel.
Mm-hmm.
Really fun, a fun story, and that got a very modest, very small deal. And so,
which would have been exciting, though. It's a deal in New York. Who cares?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it wasn't enough to kind of certainly kind of live on or anything, but it was, you know, that sort of next step. And by then I had an agent, and then I started to, after that, write The Regulars. And I sort of had two options. I was like, I can write another YA, but I haven't really managed to kind of crack that yet.
Mm.
And then I had the idea for The Regulars, which is a very kind of premise-based book, and sort of was talking about it with my agent, and she really loved the idea. And so I sort of thought, well, it's a women's fiction novel, it's adult fiction, I'll try that. And then that story just ended up coming quite quickly. And by then, had decided to work with a freelance editor, someone who I was paying for notes and feedback. Mm-hmm. And that was a great decision that really worked for me. And then I sort of really, that whole time was thinking, I want to get like a good deal with one of the big five, like one of the big publishing companies here. Like, I want a real book deal that really launches me. Like, that was the energy I was like putting into the creation of the book.
Big
and
energy.
By then, I was like 30, I think we sold it when I was like 34, 35, I'm 36 now. And it kind of felt like it's sort of going to be now or never, because I don't want to be one of those people who's like, you know, having done it for decades and hasn't had the success. So I kind of felt like if it's not this, I'm happy to pivot. I can turn. I can do something different. But because it's got to happen for me, you know, because I just want that to happen.
So tell me, like, I think one of the interesting things about writing is when a story kind of starts talking to you. Having read The Regulars, it's based on three fabulous characters in their 20s living in New York. The three of them, they all live together. They're all quite different personality-wise. And there was part of one of the characters that I kept thinking, is there a bit of Georgia in this? Was there anything, like, did it start with anything that was sort of, you felt like there was something that you could write that was a little bit about you as a direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with fiction you are exploring yourself, your take on the world, you're exploring your friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's less about exploring ideas about people you don't know, i.e. celebrities or that sort of thing, because you don't have like a true human understanding of those people, but you do have a true human understanding of the people around you that you're close to, that you sort of live with and live around, and of course yourself. So for me, the characters they're all sort of reflections of myself and reflections of young womanhood that I could identify with, either through people that I know very intimately or through sort of an interpretation of my 20s, because the characters are all in their early 20s, so they're all younger than me. But I really sort of like that. I love sort of mining the depths of my psyche out of my personality to make characters feel very real. And of course, you know, they have the characters who are funny, have my sense of humor. And yeah, so I definitely think that it's a strength. And if you are writing fiction, I think it's a good idea to make sure that your characters are, in a way, in order to make them act like people in the world, if that's the kind of fiction you're writing. I mean, even if you're writing, you know, crazy action sci-fi, your human characters need to be identifiably human. Otherwise, we lose our connection to them as readers. We don't really care about them because we don't understand how they're behaving.
Yeah.
So using yourself, I think, is a good technique.
I think the word pretty is an incredibly under-examined word in regards to how we girls and women all over the globe place so much power in it, or how the word is given so much power over us. I wonder if there is any other thing so desired by more females than any other single thing on the planet. And whilst being pretty might not be something that you grow into an adult worrying or wanting quite as much, although let's be honest, if you're pressed on this, you probably still do want it to a certain extent, but the attention that pretty gets when you're young is unbelievable. And we adults keep feeding our kids' souls with the images of what pretty is through animated movies and dolls we give them to play with. And I think it's a subject that's really interesting to contemplate, as most of us probably have our own unique story of how much pretty and the desire to be it has played into our lives, either when we're a kid or on and off throughout our lives. I think your book is fantastic and I'd urge anyone to go and get it. The premise of it is really, really interesting because it is about these three girls, the regulars, and that sort of, I guess, represents it. They're just regular girls and regular in sort of physical looks. And the whole concept of the book is that one of them comes across, is given this little potion. The potion is called Pretty. And the whole idea is if you take a couple of drops on it, then you will transform into this beautiful sort of supermodel, but, you know, incredibly pretty person, which lasts for just a week. And, of course, these three different girls, there's Evie, there's Krista, and there's Willow. And Evie is sort of sounds like, you know, similar background from you. She's working a teen mag called Salty, and she's far too clever to be working at that probably particular title. And she's very, I guess, she cares about the female, you know, the female's place in the world. And, you know, she would much rather be doing sort of feminist articles. And then there is Krista, who is an aspiring actress and, quite frankly, a little bit annoying and a bit of a flake. She is just, oh, my God, does she need a PA, this girl? And then there's Willow, who's very interesting, and she's a photographer, but she's the daughter of this, you know, very well-respected, incredible artist, a sculptor. He's a sculptor, isn't he?
A filmmaker, right.
But he's, you know, everyone, you know, she's a little bit sort of under that cloud of the daughter of. They all have their kind of issues. And I guess they all kind of get together and they talk about the fact that they've got this this little potion. And as the course of the book goes on, it shows obviously what happens from them taking this and what happens in that first week. And then they try it again. They become a bit addicted. But it's very, very interesting in what they think is going to get easier for them because they are pretty, and then what the negative side of that brings. And I think, you know, for the Evie character, which I thought was very cool, and I kept thinking of you, I just felt like her sense of humour, and of course, as I said, she sort of came from that magazine world, you know, she's in that tough position of the Salty magazine. The company wants to do an online interview kind of show, and of course, the character desperately wants to be the host of that, but she, of course, wants to try and sort of sneak some, you know, a bit more weighty and, you know, topics in there with depth. But she sort of doesn't have a chance as looking like Evie, the regular girl, because they want some, you know, model girl hosting the show. And it's only till she transforms into this incredible looking girl that they give her a go. But she's still trying to weave in that heavier content and nobody takes her seriously. I'd just love to hear from the writer's heart and head the story of the regulars.
Well, I wrote the regulars because I wanted to have a conversation about beauty. I wanted to have a conversation about beauty with myself and with potential readers. Mm. And I think what I was really interested in a kind of intellectual capacity, I was interested in talking about beauty standards, the allure of beauty, the ways in which we can have a very playful and fun relationship with beauty, as well as having a relationship that can be quite toxic and that isn't something that always makes us feel so good about ourselves. There's so many interesting kind of double standards that go on with beauty, particularly with women and men, and pressure on women to be beautiful. And that sort of goes hand in hand with being things like likable and the ways in which that we as human women in this modern world kind of deal with that. I mean, we're not idiots. You know, we understand that billboards are photoshopped, that the models in magazines are photoshopped, and yet we still feel this sort of need to, there's like an internal pressure about meeting these standards.
Because it's been programmed into us from, you know, since we were children to consider pretty.
Right. It's still a great value for women to be beautiful. You know, there's still an incredible amount of, and there's a lot of associations that go along with being beautiful. Like studies show that people who are considered beautiful are also considered to be kinder and more generous and even more intelligent. There's a lot of, you know, we make a lot of internal subconscious assumptions about people that are beautiful, and there is no denying that it's pleasing to see beauty. It's pleasing to see beauty in nature and in architecture and in people. So it's complicated. And I really came to writing the regulars because I went through a phase of feeling that I was very ugly, and that it was sort of when I was in New York and I hadn't really gotten my kind of talents into the city yet. I had friends and I had a job, but I was single and I was still kind of floaty. It was a bit of a lost time for me. It's difficult to move to a new city, and it's not something that it doesn't just take a few months to get settled. Like, it really takes a long time to get settled, and I wasn't settled. So there's many reasons why that became something that I felt very drawn to talking about.
Mm.
And I also just wanted to write. I liked the assignment, my own assignment, of writing feminist. I don't like the phrase chick lit, but the idea of writing a women's story, a story about young women that had humor and that was about relationships and was about, you know, change and growth, that was feminist. That was a story that had a diverse cast of characters and that had at the sort of heart of it a progressive set of values, but that was still really entertaining and really funny and really something that you would, you know, enjoy reading, because that's the kind of culture that I really like, you know. So I wanted to put out into the world something I would be a fan of myself.
So was it mainly kind of when you were questioning your self-worth and like, oh, what have I got to offer? You know, when you're in this massive big city and you don't feel quite part of it yet, you know, you're still trying to chip away and sort of, you know, find a place for yourself in it and convince people to pay you to have a place in it. Was it just around that time, or did Pretty and how you felt about that, was that a theme or a consciousness when you were younger or in your teens or 20s, or was it before that as well?
I feel like I was quite lucky in high school. I had a fairly sort of joyfully naive experience in high school. I had a great group of friends and we laughed a lot, and I went to school actually on the Central Coast, which is north of Sydney, and it was sort of wasn't a real city experience. It was almost like a country experience.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was before the internet, and, you know, the internet came to Australia so late in the game. I was, you know, in university by then. And so luckily I feel like I missed the kind of Instagram heavy culture that I think defines a lot of high school experience. Now, I mean, I'm not in high school, I'm not sure.
Do you think it's worse now? I guess it has to be, doesn't it? I mean, when I think back to how relevant, you know, the importance of Pretty was when I was at school, of course I forget that the internet wasn't there, but I know that it, you know, who was Pretty and whether you felt pretty, how that affected me then without the internet. But I guess you're right, it's so much worse.
I think it just exacerbates the situation. I mean, if the problem is we, and especially teenage girls, are feeling a lot of pressure to be pretty and feeling like their worth is really tied up with their appearance, then I'm not really sure how a culture of selfies kind of necessarily makes that better. You know, like, I think that, look, I'll take an odd selfie and put it on my Instagram. Like, I'm not going to come down and say that's the worst thing in the world. But I do sort of think, when we all know that social media is addicting, the way that cell phones are created are addicting, the technology is created to keep us on our phones and not turn them off. And especially when you're in high school, like, you are, and I remember being so primed for addictive behavior, like, you know, you were primed to, like, you don't just like a pop star, you were obsessed with a pop star.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just sort of like a guy or a girl, you were like,
you had to be obsessed with them,
tied up in them.
Totally.
And I think that now this kind of idea of visual culture, and especially representations of the self, of the self as being cute or beautiful or whatever, is just pervasive. It's not sort of, you know, it's everything in moderation kind of thing, but I'm not sure if that's happening in moderation.
But what I do find really in a positive way about Instagram and social media and people's physicality, because of course there's just so many vile, you know, stories to and opinions to share, is that back in, you know, my day, like, I'm 10 years older than you, but back in when I was a teenager and whatever, it was very much like, you know, the really good looking girls, it was either you were jealous or you were intimidated or you wanted to be her best friend. Whereas I find that what girls are doing now in big packs, are they fangirling? That obsession that we used to have for, say, a guy and putting posters up and all of that kind of stuff, I find that, you know, young girls, teenagers and girls in their 20s are actually more likely to be following and obsessing over another girl rather than the guys. And there's, even though I don't like to think of them sort of comparing to the hot you know, bikini girl that's got a million followers. There is something that I really like about the fact that girls are celebrating other girls, and it seems very genuine.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we could sort of talk all day about the many benefits of the internet and social media. It's a great connector, you know, it's a great way to... And it's a great way to allow other voices and other fandoms to bubble up. You know, there was such a, I think when I was a teenager, there was a very monolithic approach to pop culture. And there were really only like a handful of magazines and like a handful of television shows. And now, you know, you can, through the internet and social media, find your tribe. And you can also, there is another benefit is there's a lot more difference being shown. There's a lot more difference in sexuality being shown. We're understanding now that gender is on a spectrum, you know, that there isn't just boy-girl and that all of those things exist. But for the most part, when you sort of look at the powerful forms of the representation of culture, we're still seeing a prevalence of quote-unquote beautiful people, and that means big eyes, smooth skin, big boobs, skinny. I mean, you might have like a couple of different colours of skin in that big billboard for name this brand here, but they're going to be uniformly like young and attractive. And if you are not young and you're not attractive, then you're not seeing yourself represented in the culture. And I can't see how that increases your sense of self-worth and encourages you to sort of, you know, contribute to society and feel like you have an equal part in the great, you know, game of life that we're all in.
Another reason why the whole pretty subject I thought was really interesting, because it's kind of something that I've contemplated a lot on and off in my life, but more lately in terms of how much more work do I need to do on myself in terms of ridding myself of pointless insecurities, especially at, you know, I'm like 46 now. If I am still occasionally conscious of my looks, then I need to do work on myself, because it's just, that is a really, that's not my desired outcome, and it seems really pathetic. But if it's genuinely there, I have to acknowledge it, that it's genuinely there. I've been aware of this for a long time, but I'm just sort of thinking about it more and how can I actually overcome it? Because look, I grew up with three very, very strong women around me. So it was my nana, my mum, and my auntie. And the one thing that they shared, the three of them, and they were incredible women, there's just one little area that was a little damaging. The importance that they placed on pretty, like literally the importance that they placed on pretty, and how that would play out around me and became an insecurity thing that was planted in me, was they would say all the time when I was little, I would overhear them, and it was, they were all as bad as each other, but they would say something like, I'd be playing over in the corner and I'd hear one of them say, oh, she's having a really pretty day today, isn't she? And they'd all, they would all sit there and discuss that I was having a pretty day that day, right? So of course that felt really lovely. But the problem is that they would also do it again in earshot, and they would say, this is so bad, they would say, oh, she's having a bit of a plain day today, isn't she, the poor thing?
Oh, no.
Yeah, so they would, yeah, then point out when I was a little off in their eyes, and, you know, I had freckles, and, you know, we go through our, you know, what we feel is sort of, you know, slightly mousier hair, slightly, you know, just, you know, the teeth are coming through and they're just, or, you know, they're at that sort of preteen. You know, we're all kind of merging into ourselves. So what that actually did was it actually created a bit of a panic inside me. And I don't know whether you remember when I was working in magazines, this is a perfect example of a decade or more ago of how this has played out in my life. We would have all been in the same teen titles area, and I sat outside our boss Nicole Sheffield's office, and I would always have a tiny little mirror set up, so at any particular point I could check that mirror. It was purely to check if I was having a pretty moment or if I'd fallen off and I was having a plain moment and therefore I needed to fix it, right? So I was constantly doing the sort of rear vision mirror check on myself. And then I remember I went on holidays or I had a day off or something, and I came back and obviously other people noticed it, and it never felt like they were being bitchy or awful, but I came back once and someone had decorated put all of these mirrors around my desk area, full-length mirrors, small mirrors. There were just mirrors everywhere. So everywhere I looked, there would be these mirrors. And it was actually probably one of the worst nightmares because it was sort of prettiness overload. But I do notice that it's still an issue. Like I still do a ridiculous amount of double-checking whether I'm having the pretty moment or the plain moment, which is pretty messed
up. And that's really what we're sort of talking about as far as, like, I think that if you are occasionally worried about your look, that makes you human. I really think that's just part of the human condition, and everyone has their good days and has their bad days, and there's nothing to kind of, you don't need to go into therapy, I think, over that. It is like a lifelong conversation that you have with yourself. Like, I don't think that anyone gets to the point where they're like, oh, I've really come to terms with my own self-worth, and I value, you know, my heart and my mind, my body all at the same time, and I'm done. I'm good. You know, it just seems a little unrealistic to set out that you're going to have like this rock solid self-esteem 24/7 for the rest of your life. Because we're all aging. I think it's almost that terrible thing of you get to that stage and you realize like, oh, I've come through my troubled teen years and through my complicated 20s, and I've arrived as a fully formed woman into my 30s, and I love how I look, and that's great. And then it's like, oh, well, I'm just going to keep getting older and become an old woman, and, you know, we all turn into trolls eventually, kind of thing. So, like, it's... and that's the aim. I mean, that's what we all want.
To become trolls.
The other alternative isn't that good. The other alternative is you don't get to play at all, you know? You're off to the other side, so...
That's very true.
I think a lot of women would struggle to understand this, but as Georgia's book shows, with the three main girls in The Regulars, being pretty definitely does not make their lives perfect. There's no doubt about it, if you aren't someone who likes attention, which many of us don't, I'm a Leo, so I have a waxing and waning relationship with attention, but I'll never forget when I was about 19, I briefly hung out with this really sweet girl I'll call Laura. Laura was a gorgeous girl with curly blonde hair, pretty face, but she was someone most people would look at and describe as quite overweight. I hate saying that, but I need it for context to the story. Anyway, over a period of a year or so, after putting herself on a massive weight loss campaign, she'd gone from about a size 24 to a 10, and she looked stunning, like a completely different person. And I say this because her facial features were now more pronounced. She appeared taller because she was leaner, and to be honest, she looked like a tall Kylie Minogue. One night we went to this nightclub together. It was one of the first nights she'd been out since she lost all the weight. It was just the two of us. We both wanted to have a few drinks so we could loosen up a bit. As we walked into and around the nightclub, every guy there was staring at Laura. Honestly, I could have taken off my top and started breakdancing, and I wouldn't have got a flicker my way, which was fine. Ish. Anyway, I was a good drinker back in those days, but I couldn't help but think Laura wanting to go from bar to bar to bar doing shots of tequila at a rate that was probably going to end in tears, which it did. Laura ended up in tears at the club, saying she couldn't handle all the attention, and I got home and vomited on my own shoes, possibly in protest of not getting any attention. I didn't see Laura for a long time after that, for no other reason than she kind of dropped off the radar. But the next time I saw her, she was back to her previous size again, and she was happy. She was so much happier than she'd been on that skinny girl tequila night out. Sorry, Bethany Frankel. Which made me realise, being pretty and skinny, as the guests in George's books also find out, might not bring even remotely the kind of perfect happiness we grew up believing it would.
I would like to now talk about the characters in The Regulars, and the fact is that we are all ageing, and if you have spent your whole life relying on your looks, you're buggered, actually. You're buggered in your 40s because people stop. It's like the energy is switched off. If you were someone that strutted down the street and, you know, builders whistled at you and, you know, guys sort of looked up from their coffee and all of that sort of stuff, it starts to wind right down in your 40s, and you may be the same size. You may sort of, you know, the hair may look, everything may appear to be the same, but there is just an energy that sort of starts to go. So you have to make sure you've got these other attributes and other things to value in yourself. And I think it is interesting in your story. The fact is that these three girls, the regulars, Evie, Krista and Willow, they don't necessarily have a great time in those weeks that they are so pretty. You know, things do go pear-shaped. Can you just explain a couple of the things for the characters that they realise don't necessarily get solved by being pretty?
As you sort of outlined, each of the three young women are sort of aspiring creatives in some way, and two of them use it to enter into professional situations, and one of them, Willow, uses it more to test her relationship with her boyfriend and becomes more of a sort of psychosexual, emotional situation. The fun thing about The Regulars is, you know, you can sell the premise in a line. Three young women get their hands on something called Pretty, changes you into your ideal physical self for 1 week at a time. So it is something that reads as, like, in a way, almost like a familiar idea. But I wanted to sort of really dive into that and, like, play it through and see what would happen to your own sort of standards, your feminist ideals, your sense of how much you're in control of something like this, the way that people treat you. You know, that some doors open, but as you sort of mentioned before, we also, while we might make some really positive assumptions about beautiful people, there's a lot of negative assumptions that are made about particularly beautiful women, namely that they're stupid. Because you can't be smart and beautiful, because then I hate you and I want to kill you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's some assumptions that are made. And also, it's like, we all sort of know what it feels like when you're having one of your real pretty days.
Thanks,
and
Nana.
How amazing that can feel, Nana.
Thanks, Auntie.
And if you're having that on high, and then other things that may have seemed important to you, your set of values, your set of self, can go out the window a little bit, which is sort of what happens for particularly Evie, who is the most political character. Like, she, her sort of approach to life and her feminism is the most politicized out of the three of them. So the way that her ideals and her sense of self really start to change, and she also enters into a relationship with someone who only knows her as her pretty self, and she starts to really carve away from Evie Selby, who is her true self, into her alter ego, Chloe Fontaine, and starts to relate more to being someone else.
I just wanted to talk about Evie and her character. And so as part of what she used, you know, she uses her pretty for is to get the attention of one of her favourite authors, Velma Wolf, who is this fantastic power lesbian character. And I've totally got her in my mind. And she's just, you know, she's cool. Like, this woman is so cool. And you can see how, you know, so Evie kind of ends up dating her, and in a way it's this interesting shallow exchange that Evie's not aware of, because she ends up dating her. And, I mean, she really doesn't know Velma as a person away from her fabulous books and her, you know, kind of fame, but she desperately wants to get in there. And, of course, she's using this fake pretty because, you know, next week I'm not going to look the same. So she has this relationship. But, of course, you know, Velma trades her in the minute this other young thing shows her some interest and, you know, Evie's back is turned, or sorry, Chloe's back is turned. She's Chloe as the pretty. And so I found that really interesting that, you know what, yeah, okay, you might think, you know, you might be able to attract a certain type, but that doesn't mean that they're not also, you're not being shallow and they're also going to do the same shallow back and dump you. You know, that's life. That's got nothing to do with physicality.
That's right, because at the end of the day, like, we're all just people and we all have, you know, problems, and there are opportunities that exist beyond, like, a perceived grass is greener, beyond the perceived velvet rope. But within those worlds, there is still so much potential for heartbreak and for feelings of insecurity and for loss. And, you know, I can't imagine any public person who is noted for their looks would tell you sort of straight face, yes, my life is,
it's easier,
you know, a dream.
Yeah, my life is so much easier because I'm really pretty.
It is, you know, a double-edged sword. And I wanted to play out those ideas in a way that felt very possible, I suppose, potential.
Yeah, and I think also the Willow character, I think it's, she's obviously grown up with a father that left her mother. You know, he's obviously had beautiful younger women around him the whole time. And I understand that, having been, you know, a child that kind of, you know, came from a broken family and really watched other people and, you know, gorgeous sort of, you know, my mum's friends and, you know, my dad's friends, and, you know, they would split separate sort of social groups, but I would see them all kind of playing up to each other, and I would think, oh my God, they're all going to trade each other in, you know, if you're not sleeping with them, you're going to be sleeping with them soon, and all of this kind of thing. And it was interesting with the Willow character, because her greatest fear, and it didn't matter whether she was going to be regular Willow or Caroline, it didn't matter which versions of those she was going to be, she was always going to torment her boyfriend and sabotage it, because her fear was going to be that he was like all men, like her father, and, you know, she was going to get traded in at some point.
Right, which is, you know, exploration of the psychological scars we carry around from our family.
Yeah.
You know, Willow's father is a... Out of the three young women, Willow's father is the only character in the book. The other two families are not sort of present in New York City. And so it was an interesting thing to explore. I'm sort of interested in fame and how fame changes you and being public people. And I was just sort of curious to think through what that would be like if you were... He was sort of a famous filmmaker in the 70s. He was a notorious womanizer, you know, which sort of calls to mind a few characters from that time that we know of, and what would happen if he had a daughter in New York and she was sort of coming of age now, and what would their relationship be like? How would she relate to men? And so that was, it was interesting. Out of the three characters, as you probably haven't read the book, but you probably can pick up, like, Evie is more of the every girl. Her storyline is, you know, thoughtful and funny, and she is sort of the central character in a way. And then Willow and Krista are sort of more exaggerated. Willow is much darker and her storyline is sort of psychological, and Krista is a hot mess and she's comic relief. So
such a hot mess.
It's fun.
A brilliant
to
hot mess.
Sort of flip between the three sort of moods and tones to keep things, you know, nice and pacey.
It's fun. But it does, I think, question your how you know your belief on you know how much you value pretty and how that's played out in your life. And I think it's really, really interesting. So normally how I finish an episode of The Wise Guides, Georgia, is I ask my guest what they would like the world to know more about the topic that we've been talking about. But what I've decided to do is, considering you are an author and probably what you would like the world to know a lot about is where they can buy your books and follow your career, and so you can keep being this fabulous author living in New York City and making me jealous. So I'm going to just give out a few of your details so people can follow you, and seriously, get The Regulars. It's fantastic. It's not just me. Us Weekly thinks so, and a whole bunch of other magazines. So, Georgia, you're on Twitter and Instagram. Correct me if I'm wrong. At Georgia Lou Clark with no E on the end. Your website is georgiaclark.com. The book is The Regulars, as we've said. And also, tell me about this, the Proactive Author offer that you're giving.
So I created an online course called The Proactive Author, which is a book marketing course for self-published and to be published authors. So it's an author-focused course on all things book marketing and book promotion. I learned a lot from doing my own launches for up to three books now. And there's a lot of online courses for the craft of writing and actually sort of, you know, how to write a book, but not a lot focused around what you should do once you've got a book that you want to put out. And so whether you're being published through a small or a big press or whether you're self-publishing, it's an 8-part online course that focuses on everything you need to know, from doing events, creating community, your presence online, putting together a press release, just building up a audience for yourself. And if whether you're doing that in partnership with your publishing company or whether you're doing it on your own, you can see that it's hosted through my website, georgiaclark.com. And I'd love to offer all listeners a 15% discount through using the promo code FRIENDLY15 at checkout.
Oh, that's so cool. Thank you. And I'm going to do that, because I think the thing is, yeah, I mean, publishers, doesn't matter how big you, big or small your publisher is, they want you to do the work behind it as well and help market your book. So thank you so much, and congratulations on again with The Regulars, because it's still building and it's still getting reviewed all over the world, and just hope it continues to go where it's supposed to, and I can't wait for your next book.
Oh, thank you, Amber. I'm sure I speak for everyone listening when I say we can't wait for you to write your book, because we want to read that book.
Oh, God, no, I don't want you to read it. No, no, no. I want people that have never written a book before to read it and go, she's not bad, but not you. and not Jessica Biel. Either.
I'm definitely going to give it to Jess. So,
oh my God.
Too bad.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, love.
If you've enjoyed this episode of The Wise Guides, we'd love you to share it with your friends and subscribe to the show to receive more like this by heading to iTunes or novafm.com.au. This episode was written by me, Amber Petty, and produced in the Nova Entertainment Podcast Studios. Executive producer Andy Milne, audio engineering by Matt Argoon.